Hello. Let us hope that April is the cruelest month. But here we are, as everybody keeps saying, because everybody feels they're not really here because where they are is so familiar. Each of us has a chorus of personality states inside us, saying each of them at one or another time, or sometimes all together, this is not my life. And as you can feel the multiplicity of personality now, you can feel the multiplicity of those denials, this is not my life. Each of those different states with each of those different lives, sure, if of nothing else, that this is not my life. Pedagogically, of course, that raises the question, who is learning here? And at least in some part, that is why I feel the weakness of what we're doing. Because when we're together, when we're actually together, when we can see one another and talk to one another, I can have some sense among the multiplicity of the personalities of the people I'm speaking to, who is learning and what each of those states is learning. And this, the relationship of not ideas but personalities, that part of teaching which consists of watching persons learn, is lost altogether. Now, some might say that in law school it is often lost. Student-faculty ratio is very high, and some teachers are both willing and able to try and cross that boundary between selves and selves many dozen times. But even those who are, and those who will, and those who try are inevitably falling short, as against what happens in a seminar or in a tutorial or in a small class, where the ability to screen out the personalities of students requires more effort to be backed up, and where the effort not to know is, you know, it requires more. But even in law school, where so much is often lost, of course nothing can be lost completely. And if you're sensitive to it, to the subtlety and beauty of the fact that multiple personality states are learning in school, and that they are learning differently, and that people's responses from time to time to the learning experience are different because their states are shifting. If the beauty and subtlety of all of that is accessible to you, then teaching is the most extraordinary form of making things happen in society using words. Extraordinary precisely because it doesn't have the relentless mercilessness of the law. But it does have a quality of honest magic about it. And that we're all denied. I am, of course, feeling very apologetic and embarrassed because my work in editing your writing is so far behind. And I thought last week I would be done, and last week I wasn't done, and this week I'm still not done, and maybe against all the other time constraints of the strange life we live in, which we never go anywhere, but we are always supposed to be more productive, maybe I will actually have finished, and you will have edited writing to think about and to revise. I don't think that in the ungraded environment it makes sense for me to demand a second essay from you. it is more than sufficient for you to do one essay and one revision at least in order to ascertain that you have passed. I will not prevent anybody from writing a second essay. I will be happy to edit it, and I hope that by the end of April I will have figured out how to balance all the time that I need for all the things I need without ever leaving my apartment, and I will be a more relentless editor. But at any rate, let us assume for our purposes that the second essay is optional, and that it is up to you what you want to do, but you will pass on the basis of the first essay and the revision to it, which you can begin to make as soon as I have done my part of the job. That's housekeeping for today. There are two other matters of housekeeping that are on my mind, but in my isolation booth here, I'm not yet ready to decide them. The first is whether we can use conference calling to supplement our online office hours. If we do, it will be a one-off experiment rather than a shift in style. I believe that online office hours in Etherpad land are useful, and I believe that they have value because multiple conversations can be going on at one time during that time. Whatever else is true about phone calls with or without bad pictures, as you are aware from the Zoomification experience, not only does the entirety of learning have to go on in one time zone and in one time slot, which I think is a drawback, but also, of course, only one thing can be going on at a time, and that, while it may seem comforting as a recapitulation of the classroom experience, is not actually the best way to go, from my opinion. So Etherpad space, which has the advantage that we can regulate multiple conversations at the same time and be thinking about more than one thing at once and writing about more than one thing at once, is, from my point of view, superior. But it might be, and I'm trying to decide under what circumstances and how to test, that the town hall quality of conference calling is desirable too. I will not Zoomify under any circumstances, as you see. The more that the truth is revealed, the more it is apparent how many things are wrong with Zoom, from the point of view of privacy, from the point of view of security, from the point of view of social process, more passwords, more waiting rooms, more complications, and of course, more offstage manipulation by servers in China and all the rest of it. But the telephone system is good, and lawyers need telephones. Lawyers need telephones because telephones are the way that informal conversation can happen among lawyers. That recordlessness of the unrecorded telephone call, a thing which to some significant extent law helps us to achieve via regulations concerning the recording of telephone calls without consent, legislation which, because it is 20th century legislation, assumes a telephone, as so much of our wiretapping law assumes a telephone. This is why, in my practice, telephones are what we use. We do have a sophisticated voice over IP telephony, all of which is headquartered inside a very small virtual machine, inside a very small physical server in my ever more small apartment, using a piece of free software called Asterisk, which, if you are planning your practice, is part of what you should plan to use, because even if a law firm can't have a building of its own, in order to sustain its privacy and the privilege of its clients, every law firm can have a telephone system of its own very inexpensively, very effectively, and at least for calls within the virtual law firm itself, with exceedingly high security, using the wonderful free software, soft exchange called Asterisk. At any rate, we could, without involving any third parties and using the system called the telephone, which has an awful lot of pro-privacy legal regulation attached to it, both with respect to government activity and with respect to unauthorized private listening and recording, we can use the telephone system to achieve all the wonderfulness of Zoom without the primary colors and the initials, and perhaps we will. I have not decided, but if we're going to have at least one conference call office hour session, I will post that information ahead of time along with the call-in number on my practice's conference bridge. Yes, we can run conference calls for 40. Yes, we can do that at so little cost that the use of a free service run by a data miner wouldn't be an advantage. And just imagine what it is that universities like Columbia are paying Zoom in order to data mine the crap out of their education systems. The second thing that is housekeeping that we will need at some point to come to grips with is the declaration of the so-called Dean's Honors, which was not discussed with the faculty as a whole, but only among the dean and some committees, and which raises some issues that perhaps are more of principle than of process, which we may need to discuss. But in the world in which we are keeping Martha Tharau waiting at the corner of Maiden Lane and Nassau Street, where once upon a time I lived, and where almost exactly half a century before that, my grandfather had a jewelry shop, and where roughly 200 years before that, Aaron Burr had a house with a grape arbor in the backyard where the lawyers of Lower Manhattan liked to gather and sit. Rather than keeping Martha Tharau waiting there at the corner of Maiden Lane and Nassau Street any longer for our housekeeping, perhaps we should turn to the real from the merely imaginary. Martha is unquestionably real. Of all the portraits drawn by Larry in his book, including Robinson, I think it is at one and the same time apparent that she is a character of just extraordinary profundity, and at the same time that she's not a character at all. She's a real person, not named Martha Tharau, and no longer alive. Fortunately, I think, if Martha were at this moment still among us, nearly 90, and frail, as her strength inevitably would have become frailty by this point, then she would be among those of whose death I would be continuously afraid. Last week was the week in which people I know started to die in numbers in New York City. In that legal community of downtown, moreover, that Martha and the poet are walking over on their way to meet Serriere. Last week, there died two lawyers I worked with when I was a kid lawyer, one of them downtown in that Chase building with the buffet outside, and one with whom I was professionally connected when I was a law clerk and he was appearing in a trial before my judge. Kevin Thomas Duffy of the Southern District of New York, long retired, died last week too. KTD was a man I dealt with on a more or less daily basis when I was a clerk in the building, and before whom I had a case once, and had a massively lucky ability to draw we'll see criminal cases throughout his career. Somehow, in the randomness of criminal assignment, where we'll see is the long cases, the ones that take months to try and that are constantly in the newspapers, Kevin Thomas Duffy had a magic touch at receiving those cases. He tried a dozen of the largest of the criminal cases in New York City over a generation, and whatever was the magic that caused the wheel to send him those cases, he was pretty good at running long criminal trials, that's for sure. Bucky Pizzarelli, a wonderful jazz guitar player whom I used to listen to around town all the time, at 94, and that was the easy week. The week when people who were simply part of my world, but not close to me, died. Right? And like everybody else in this city right now, I know that that's probably about to change. That's what it means to live in the time of the plague, of course. Your world gets smaller in many different ways at once, not merely to be restricted to a room or two, not merely to be physically aware of the fact of confinement. It is also the restriction that comes from the knowledge that your world is getting smaller. The loss of all those jobs is tightening the lives of millions of people around us. And though you fear the loss of your futures, I have tried and will continue to try to help you understand that your future is not lost, it's merely changed. But the past dies in the time of the plague. The world we have known, the people who populated it, more than just populated in the sense that they were on the street or in the room, made it, judged it, litigated it, played it, showed it, danced it, wrote it down. The world grows smaller because we are losing the people who made it larger. And yet, of course, it's also spring. I look out from my isolation booth at the buds on all the trees in the park. I see the light on the Mesopotamian mausoleum that is Grant's tomb, the capitalist's greatest monument to the drunken failure who saved the Union for them. I can see the spring quality of the current, the tide, and the wind on the Hudson River. And I know that life is beginning again with all the imperviousness to everything that life on the planet Earth has. It's simply going on. And we who have been here less than the half of a 10,000th of the blink of a geological eye, we who have overrun the planet and changed it immensely, we may be sheltering from the plague, but life, which includes not just the plague and us, but everything else too, is declaring that its future has not been canceled in any way. The forsythia know that. The daffodils know that. The trees, God knows, know that. Manhattan is a Canarsie, Algonquian word. It means the place of little brooks, which, of course, this island with its granite spininess and all the water running down from everywhere onto all the waters of the world. Manhattan, that place of little brooks, no matter how much it has been concretified and dammed up and runs its water different ways, is still a place where every drop has to run into the rivers somewhere. And the spring has that relentlessness in the place of little brooks, no matter how much brick and mortar we have laid down on it. And so the past is disappearing and the future is unrolling temporarily without us. And the hawks are leaving because there's stuff to find up a little further north, denser than here. But a few have stayed behind to pick off the squirrels as they emerge and go about their business. And in the night, where there's less traffic than there used to be, I hear the owls working Riverside Park more than one would in a busier and less owlish time. If we are cooped up, they are a little less so, always. And out there looking for things in their silent, relentless radar way, the owls are a reminder that death and life are always part of the enlargement of the world as well as of its shrinking. But here is Tharo standing in her space, a real, not imaginary person in all the ways that imagination can create reality. Her selfhood was not given her by the poet, it was given her by her experience in life. And if she were here, we would fear her perishing, but she is safely dead and gone. And in many respects, the world of which she was a part has gone too. But in ways which it is most helpful for us, as we think about what it means to be a lawyer, to understand. I think, in a sense, the first of places to begin, though there are so many here, because her balance of skill and daring and her wisdom are many points of entry to lawyering, but I think the place for us to begin most is by taking up again the theme we were talking about last time in relation to you, that the durable motivations for going to law school and becoming a lawyer, at least so far as I have learned them in my third of a century of thinking about it, the durable motivations for going to law school are two: the love of justice and the hatred of injustice. And I think it would be fair to say that in her way, a way which we can think about, ought to think about with all the nuance that she believes in bringing to appreciation of the world, she is an appreciator in the same way that Judge Celia Day is a discerner, I think. The meaning of her appreciation of the world is the hatred of injustice. Her hatred, like all the rest of her aggression, is civilized in every sense. That is to say, when she wishes to do harm to Serriere, she does it ruthlessly and unjustly, if you like. But her aggression is at all times aimed against what has been the ruling injustice of her life. And as she says in Ying's about the ability to deduce all of the social, economic, and political system from any one relationship of employment, her hatred of injustice concentrates itself also there, in the abusiveness of the system of employment, in its pathologies and its normal institutionalizations of the arbitrary economic rule of the few over the many. this is what gives light to her determination to be a lawyer. In the end, what motivates her is the hatred of the injustice that workers are cheated and abused, and most of all, that they get fired. This, the central structure of economic power, particularly in this society where at-will employment is the overwhelming rule, where the worker's ability to keep a job depends from moment to moment on the will of the employer, this injustice is the one which has motivated her. No doubt it had motivated her even in law school when, as she points out in response to Serriere, the Wagner Act, the National Labor Relations Act, was passed, but differently understood, let us say, by Arthur Pendleton III on the one hand and by John Lewis on the other. The great structure of the world of unjust power for her comes down to the power of the employer to take away the job and to create a crisis of sustainment in any household. This, most of the time, we think of as though it were part of the struggle of 20th century American life, the rise and fall of the labor union. The lesson of the depression and mass unemployment and the struggle of workers to hold on to the ability to live in a time of deprivation, followed by the long flourishing of labor unions and industrial scale collective bargaining on the one hand, and the post-1980 structure of undermining and decline that led to the appropriation of a larger and larger portion of American wealth by a smaller and smaller number of people. Part of what, after all, Serriere is quite rightly pointing out in his concluding aria. But all of that, too, is how one taught law school until the day before yesterday, until March of 2020, when, after all, we suddenly discovered that the history was not only not past, it wasn't even big. At the height of the Depression, in 1934 and 35, maybe I should say at the depth of the Depression, around the time that my own parents were born, the unemployment rate in the United States was roughly 25%. And there were 15 million Americans out of work. In the last 2 weeks, more than 10 million Americans have filed unemployment insurance claims. And of course, what that means is, because the number of workers who are entitled to file unemployment insurance claims, even after recent legislative effort by the United States Congress and the CARES Act, is not all, by any means, not even the overwhelming majority of workers. If 10 million workers in the United States have filed unemployment insurance claims in the last 2 weeks, then somewhere near as many people have lost their jobs in the last 2 weeks as were jobless in the depths of the Depression. Now, to be sure, we are a much larger country and a much larger economy. But our unemployment rate is likely to reach that of the depth of the depression in percentage terms, which will mean immediate threat to the ability of more than 20 million families in the United States to live. It is, of course, true that lots of small businesses are also disappearing or at threat of disappearance. It's not only the employee, but also the employer who dies or risks economic death in the midst of this plague, which also brings so much destruction of our bodies and our histories and our lives. To be a small business person in this storm is to contemplate the need to fire people. My practice employs at the moment, fortunately, a relatively small number of people. We are fewer lawyers than usual, owing to the give and take of both my budget and my employees' lives. But here and in India, the money that I find for our practice and the money that Mishy finds for our practice must now sustain, let us say, roughly a dozen people's lives. It happened when this began that we were in relatively good shape for the year. I know how to keep everybody paid until early in the fall. And I am the last employer my insurance agent knows who still pays 100% of all the health insurance premiums for our employees. I don't consider it moral to charge people for their health insurance. So I know that if my practice survives, those households will live. And health insurance will be there for people and their spouse and their children. And I know that if the practice doesn't make it, then those jobs will go away. So, of course, it isn't only the employee, it's also the employer who has to deal with these problems of urgency and immense weight. But in a system of at-will employment, which is pretty much what we have now that a mere 10% of the private workforce in the United States is unionized, in fact, a little less than 10%, now that we live in a world where at-will employment is the overwhelmingly dominant form of employment relationship, even at the most universal of hard times, which this moment is, the difference between the employer and the employee is simply that the employer gets to make the choices. The power, however much its exercise may be unpleasant, hopeless, sad, the power rests on one side and one side only. And it is in that asymmetry of power, the employment relationship, that Martha Tharrow found her hatred of injustice concentrated and built a lawyer's life out of it. You see the importance to her of the lawyer who mentored her, Lewis Harris, as you see the importance of that mentoring relationship in all law practices, including yours. The thing which legitimately justifies, if there is such a thing as a legitimate justification for this belief that large law firms are a training ground, the thing that legitimately justifies that, if anything does, is that in large law firms there are lots of lawyers, some of whom are valuable, perhaps invaluable, mentors. Some of whom are. And some of whom are not, which is why there really isn't any such thing for you as big law. There are large firms who might have partners in them who will be mentors to you as important as Lewis Harris was to her. Phenomenal lawyer, she calls him, and indeed, the lawyers who can help other people grow as lawyers are a phenomenon of great importance, and any practice must have them, whether it is tiny or very large. But you, in any law practice of which you are a part, either have a mentor or you do not. There comes some stage in your career, of course, where you are the mentor. And the nature of your practice in its relation to younger lawyers will be determined by the extent to which you regard that mentoring as the any part of the focus of your practice. My practice, as I say, is a teaching practice. That means that for me, mentoring is primary in it. It can't be larger than serving clients, but it can be almost as large. In such a practice, for example, it is necessary to bear with the errors of lawyers. In the course of growing up, we make mistakes. In some places, that is, practices whose primary concern isn't teaching, mentoring, whose primary concern is the income of the partner, the appropriate response to mistakes by salaried employee lawyers is to fire them. Or if not to fire them, at least to collect sufficient reason why one would never be partnered with them. In my practice, the need not to commit malpractice is as severe and absolute as it is in any other practice. The lawyer must ultimately produce results which are within the range of acceptable legal practice, which means, of course, that young people's mistakes have to be corrected. But in order for learning to occur, failure must occur, a thing which I recognize. It is hard in law school to accept, even if we are pass fail, still fail must not happen. But fail does happen, and fail is crucial in the process of learning. The experimentation with the world, whether you are John Dewey or you're Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., the experimentation with the world that is thinking inevitably involves failed experiments, and experiments failed in design and experiments failed in execution by contamination and mistake. Mentoring, then, is the process of helping lawyers to learn by failure without allowing failure to occur for clients. And it's a drag. It takes more time. It's more complicated. There are parts of mentoring which don't have to do with orientation towards mistake. They have to do with getting young people in the room. But mostly they have to do with enabling the lawyer's imagination as well as her skill. And this is what Martha Tharrow owes to Lewis Harris. Her understanding of the greatness of his lawyering is perfect in its simplicity. She specializes, as you see, in gems. Lewis Harris substantially raised, the standard of living of tens of thousands of people. This is a definition of a lawyer's life, right? He was phenomenal because he did it. He was phenomenal because those hundreds of thousands of people had their standards of living raised, and because he did it. Lewis was a phenomenal lawyer. Lewis helped change considerably and for the better the living standards of hundreds of thousands of people. Now, the practice in which Lewis Harris and she worked together was a practice built around the National Labor Relations Act and the labor union economy. Part of that was the litigation around the system. Union election litigation, card signing litigation, the recognition litigation, strikes, and all that follow from it, but very largely collective bargaining. Negotiating the agreements, first in his career, no doubt by himself, and later in the relationship with the union systems of business agents in locals, and in national and international business agents and contract negotiators, that was the system by which employees collectively bargain for their wages, their conditions of work, and their security of employment. Tharrow is in the room because he took her there. Arthur Pendleton may have considered her to be an invisible colored girl, of course. That's her point. And come back to the invisible, the colored, and the girl in due course. But in the room is where you have to be, and mentoring means, among other things, getting you in the room. I was sitting once on an airplane headed from San Francisco to Europe, and then I was headed on in one direction, and my seatmate in the business class cabin was headed in another. And we got to talking in the first 30 minutes of the international flight. He was an investment banker, but a peculiar investment banker in this way, that the book that he was reading on the airplane was a book of a kind that you and I might be more inclined to pick up. It was one of the many books of Judge Richard Posner. So we got to talking, and I talked to him a little bit about Posner and William Brennan's view of him and my view of him, and lots of mere minor stuff. And after a while, he looked at me and he said, "Oh," he said, "so it was Thurgood Marshall who got you in the room." Well, I said, the IBM lawyers and a little bit the Cravath lawyers and sometimes Judge Weinfeld, but of course we need to consider that the room at the Supreme Court is a room that the justices can't get you into because only they are allowed to go into it. I said, but in a larger sense, certainly that's right. And he said, "Well, it was Ken Chenault who took me in the room." Ken Chenault was the chief executive of American Express. Is an enormously successful example of the aristocracy of American business, and the first African American to be the CEO of a major financial company in the United States. And so here he and I were, two white guys who had been taken in the room at the beginning of our lives by overwhelmingly important people in the United States who happened atypically also to be black folks. But what was important at that moment was the fact that was so clear to him in his Morgan Stanley-ness, as it is clear to me, and I hope clear to you as you think about how your career will be shaped in this big law you think you're going to be joining. The crucial thing that can be done for you at the beginning of your career by the importances you work for is that they can take you in the room, that you can be there seeing how it is done, when it is done, where it is really done, where face-to-face, in one place, people do the things that we call exercising power. This, more than anything else, is what you are getting, if you're getting anything from the big law you think you're joining. It is the being inside. But Tharo, in her understanding of what it means to be inside, sees that she wishes to be inside and was brought inside and trained by Lewis Harris to be inside as a dangerous person. Because if what you are motivated by is the hatred of injustice, then you are dangerous to injustice, or you are not serving your purpose. The meaning of your practice is absent if you are not in some way being dangerous to injustice. And as she rightly says, from the point of view of the young lawyer, dangerousness comes in very substantial measure from invisibility, from the being there, from the observing how it works, for being able to collect the information and to understand the outcomes as a function of the way that people actually, from moment to moment in their social interactions, lawyering and clienting and employing and firing and contesting firing, the ways in which we are actually exercising leverage to make things happen in society using words, and yet we're not the ones responsible right now. At a later stage of our practices, when we are grown into everything that must be happening, at that later stage, we are both present and dangerous, but also visible and accountable. In the beginning, if it is correctly done, if it is properly understood, if everybody has performed the tasks of mentoring and being mentored right, then it is the ability to be there without having to participate, which is the greatest element of your growing danger. But Tharo's form of training, the growing up under the wing of Lewis Harris, going from being invisible to visible, from hating injustice and working to confront it to being in the front of the confrontation with injustice. Martha Tharo's name on a complaint is $250,000, says Serriere enviously. Martha's growth in power and practice, as she wishes to point out, occurs, you know, as Lewis Harris says, on liberty, which begins and ends with the Federal Reserve. This is part of what, for her, is embedded in that landscape, that the faux-strozzi Federal Reserve at the corner of Liberty and Maiden Lane, in between Liberty and Maiden Lane, the meaning of capital and its forceful, sometimes beautiful, extraordinarily opaque power lies behind every other piece of this system of justice and injustice in which she participates. And here you can certainly see the fullness of that in our present world, in which the immense economic calamity we are going through is mediated and perhaps mitigated and maybe even replanted and restructured by the force of the capital resting passively, actively, digitally, and really in the basement where the gold is at the Federal Reserve. The landscape of her practice also happens to bring us Once again, the figure of another part of the past of New York, Roy Cohn. I heard a lot of people did Roy Cohn. And right she is about that. And right she is about the immensity of his fame and influence. And of course, it is impossible now to read Thoreau and Serriere in their duet and to think of her recollections of Roy Cohn and how many people he hurt, how mean and difficult to overcome he was in his darkness, his fame, his nastiness. It's impossible for us to read this now and not remember that the pussy grabber who was trained in all of the conflict and polarization and division and darkness by Roy Cohn, whose mentee is now the most powerful man in the world and the president of the United States. This irony of the nature of the history of this Manhattan Island, where I know her as she really was and Roy Cohn as he really was, and saw Donald Trump first in my life when I was 26 years old in the presence of Roy Cohn. All of this, like those archaeological layers in all of these lives, including mine, my grandfather's, Aaron Burr's, Alexander Hamilton's, all resting together on the corner of Maiden Lane and Nassau Street. That locale, which is the poet's way of working all these stories through the spaces of that piece of Manhattan. But as Walt Whitman says, you know, it contains multitudes, and it turns out that in those few paces, their walk to the water and back on Maiden Lane, down Pearl Street, and across to meet Serriere, the history of American past and present and the future and all those employment relationships, all those exercises of power over people's lives, it's all available for us to turn in our hands like a crystal with irregular facets shining and reflecting in all directions. This walk, this conversation, the Cokes and Rice at Ying's, the discussion of the reading of the employment relationship, any employment relationship as a microcosm containing worlds, all of this is both carefully, poetically imagined and at the same time absolutely real. Thoreau herself, her dress, her jewelry, her appreciation of the public art of Lower Manhattan, her sense of what it means to be a lawyer, are one strand of the poem. The truth, she says, this I believe, the truth is ultimately revealed. In the end, we face this gap. The truth is somewhere between what we know and what we can prove. But in the end, we come there. This, though she doesn't necessarily reflect on it in this way, this is, after all, her pragmatism in the large P American philosophic sense. She's agreeing, after all, with William James and Charles Peirce and John Dewey that as James says, the truth is what the community of investigators is fated to agree upon in the long run. It has, in James's formulation, the usual James family quality of fate and the workings of the cosmos, which is not how she thinks of it. The truth is revealed. That's partly the world working its geological magic, moving the tectonic plates around, but it's mostly the work of the lawyers and the others whose job it is to ferret out the truth, to mine it from where it is in that indistinct state between what we know and what we can prove, and to bring it to the light where we will be forced, all of us, to face it and agree upon it. She is speaking, after all, to us from that world now passing, that place in which the post-truth society hadn't yet been created by that protege, that mentee of Roy Cohn, that pussy grabber, the president of the United States. But what she is saying is for us what her near contemporary, her younger sister Nancy Pelosi is saying from the high rostrum of the House of Representatives, that in the end, the truth will come and will set us free. And whether this is true or not, in any given sense, it is, from Tharo's point of view, the way it works. And once again, I would say that to believe that that's the way it works, to make that the meaning of one's practice, is to come to it from the hatred of injustice. Justice and truth are not the same. Judge Celia Day thinks that's because the law of the streets, you get what you deserve, is the principle to which law comes. And justice has, in that sense, the rudimentary character of caring less about truth than it cares about desert. This is why so much of our mythology of justice contains the lawman who just wants to give people what they deserve rather than letting the process run in its corrupt way, in which the lawyer, so everybody from Dirty Harry to the Star Chamber to the Captain Marvels of the world are all engaged in making justice, never mind the truth. But for those who hate injustice more than they love justice, the ultimate revelation of the truth is why you can win, because in the end the truth is a weapon against injustice. And in that respect, the employment relationship is a place of ultimate twisting and bending of truth. Why did you fire him? I didn't like his face is sufficient for the point of view of an at-will employment system. Though there are things one cannot like about a face, including what its color is, that cause one to have to be subject at least a little bit to principles of injustice in employment. So I didn't like his face isn't what one says. One says because this, because that, he did this, he did that. And in a world in which the accusation doesn't have to be proven anywhere, there's no union grievance process to make the employer come clean about things, even a little bit, even in some potentially corruptible system of local private justice, there's only my reason, so often my pretext, for firing somebody. And so, for Tharo, the ultimate fact that truth is revealed is both a detail of practice and a source of the possible of power with which we confront and subdue injustice. But there are so many other ways in that she offers us, because though we don't see her mentoring in this, we don't see the younger lawyers she has helped to train over the years, the ways in which her law firm is in itself a resource of that kind of learning for young people. As the great labor law firm of Bretthoff and Kaiser in Washington, D.C. was over the years a place of such significance in the way that it trained lawyers in my generation. Though we don't see her mentoring, we can feel the power of her ability to do it in her conversation with the narrator, which is, of course, a distillation of some of the most important parts of what it is that she has to teach lawyers. And in this, it is her quality as an appreciator, as a learner for the purpose of breadth of knowledge. Her sense of the nature of what it is to be not a dim lawyer, but a bright lawyer, is so powerful and important. One can sense what she has told the generation of lawyers she has trained about this, that you have to be interested, that you have to want to know, that you have to be prepared to go into the edges of what it is that a lawyer knows. Her last piece of wisdom before Serrière, it's something that you don't realize until you're older. Most people are dim. I don't mean mean or stupid, although there are plenty of dim people who are also mean and stupid. I mean something else. A thickness, a thick-headedness, a dullness. When you're younger, you say to yourself, who am I to presume someone is dull? But the older you get, you realize you've wasted so much time lost. No appreciation of subtlety, of beauty, that's what it is. That finally is what it is. To know anything about beauty, you have to take the trouble to learn. Most lawyers are like most everyone else. They don't take the trouble to learn anything other than what puts money into their pockets. I know it sounds like a cliche, but it isn't even a cliche anymore. Nobody talks about it anymore. What happens is one day the dimwits wake up in a what is life really about stupor, but it's too late. It's already over. So they try to bring you down into their misery. This is both a theory of the origin of injustice, you see, the disappointments and the dimnesses and the absence of appreciation of beauty and subtlety causing people to become prone to the commission of injustice themselves. As they both concentrate on what makes them rich, that is to say, the psychoactive value of money is an antidepressant of an addictive kind. Like cocaine, the problem of the psychoactivity of money is the immensely high tolerance one builds up towards it. This is what the relevance of Thorsten Veblen is to this piece of the poem, but I leave that for a week from now when we are actually reading Thorsten Veblen. The part of this which is immediate to her theory of the creation of injustice is, after all, that like cocaine, that the money doesn't continue to shoot you up quite so quickly each time. It falls away a bit. My own personal experimentation, as they like to call it, with cocaine occurred in college, and I used it once, and it was so amazing that I said to myself, I'm never doing this again, and never did. Because, of course, the moment that I first ingested the substance, it made me feel that I had finally achieved what would really be smart, and my brain was perfect, and I could learn anything, and everything could teach me everything, and then I knew that there's a dose-response curve, the tolerance that one has. The next time it would have been a little less good, and the time after that, and the time after that, and so you use a little bit more, and you use a little bit more, and then it's cocaine. So one day, for whatever reason, the little bit more you use stops your breathing, and you're dead. But money, unfortunately, though at least until the plague it doesn't cut off your breathing and you're dead, it doesn't work to take away that sense of is this all there is-ness? What is life really about? It provides against the depression that she's talking about, but only a little bit each time less. And pretty soon, of course, 1% of the population owns half of all the wealth in the society, but that doesn't mean that they possess anywhere near half of all the happiness. The other part of what she's saying here, after all, is about a lawyer's education. A lawyer's theory of social action is appreciative as well as outraged in Thoreau's world. Everywhere you look, you can see immediately in any relationship of employment that you come upon all that there is to be concerned about, outraged about, angry about, willing to fight over in the injustice of the system. And at the same time, without that appreciation of subtlety and beauty, without the willingness to learn how to appreciate the breadth of things beyond the practice that one can monetize, without that effort to see more, that dimness hovers always, that what is the meaning of my practice, of my life, with the turn to the darkness that can always in an instant start to bring about. In her vibrancy, in her awareness of the Louise Nevelsons outside the Federal Reserve, my father and Louise Nevelson worked together once or twice on professional projects, and I met her when she was not 90 or 80 or even 70, but when she was about the age that Tharo is when we meet her here. And I know, as Tharo herself does, that Larry Joseph needs her and Louise Nevelson as kin in this story. Martha Tharo tells us that a lawyer and an artist can be the same, even if they're not. And even if the impulse to raise hundreds of thousands of people's standards of living isn't exactly why a sculpture comes into existence, still at the same time, but this also has to do with being colored. It will, I have no doubt, surprise people that once upon a time my folks was colored folks. That seems so evidently impossible because we have been, that is, Jews have been white in the United States for two generations now almost, and what that has done to everybody is not necessarily what I would have wanted for my people and myself. It is, however, an important biographical fact about her, or for that matter, me, or perhaps for that matter, you, to understand that this line between the colored folks and the white folks is movable for almost everybody. Almost everybody. In dealing with Thurgood Marshall on a day-to-day basis, if your job was to help, to assist, to speak for, to represent, and sometimes to bother, you learned fairly early that there was a verbal formulation you had to be careful to avoid. If incautiously or naively or without adequate understanding, one said to Thurgood Marshall, "Boss, you have to do such and such," whatever the such and such was, there was an automatic response. The only two things I have to do, TM would say, whenever have to floated by him, the only two things I have to do are stay black and die. A powerful message, very important to receive, but like most of the folks who worked for him over the years, I think I did not wish to receive it frequently. I wanted him to understand that I could learn that lesson if it was taught to me once. The line between colored people and white people in our society is movable, but it is hardly movable for people who must, as he said, stay black and die. You see in the response of the human body to the plague that to possess a black body in America is, among other things, to be more subject to the plague, not as a consequence of biology, but as a consequence of society. Nonetheless, it is relevant as a historical proposition to observe that once upon a time, Martha Thoreau was colored and Oriental. And to have lived in a society in which you have gone from colored and Oriental to Judeo-Christian is an illusory journey which some of us have taken and which it is obvious we don't believe in literally, but rather with an understanding of the depth of the obscenity of injustice which can categorize anybody in this way. But it wasn't merely being colored or Oriental or Levantine. It was also being female. Were you aware of being a woman? Says the narrator. And there we meet for the first time the shiv she has, which we see used with such energy on Serier. What a question to ask. Was I aware of being a woman? All the indignities, so many indignities. I think it's important to freeze that conversation and carry it across the generation which has succeeded her into the world in which we live now. As she rightly says, there were few women in the profession when she arrived and few in law school when she went there. And now, in a well-appointed, carefully arranged, adequately diverse law school as we are, the men and women are approximately equal in their access to the privilege of this wonderful education now. But the indignities? Surely, you see that the indignities have lessened only slightly. There is, to be sure, a great deal of what we are informed is political correctness around. One might consider that also to be an effort to eliminate indignities. But they don't. The extraordinary aspect of this, the harm to dignity that is constant all the time. The law is a dignified profession. Lawyers are dignified people, by which we mean that we are oversupplied with that quality of dignity which we hope we are equal in possessing in our society, that we have something that we think of as egalitarianism and something that we think of as an appreciation of the importance of dignity in human society, and we as lawyers are inclined, as we usually are, to get at least our share of what it is appropriate for human beings to want. But within that dignified profession that is the law, it is impossible not to observe the continual regime of indignity which half of us suffer from. All the indignities. Now, to be sure, we are also in the presence of the case that she is settling with Serriere, and the problem of the grabbers and the pawers and all the stuff that Me Too has only scratched the surface of. But Thoreau's not just talking about overt harassment. He's not talking only about sexual coercion or profiteering or the effort to achieve equal dignity requires a level of reform of social practice which extends substantially beyond not raping people. Right? And to say that were you conscious of your being a woman has the same quality of obtuseness about it that is found everywhere in the United States on the subject of color. T.M. used to say, and I believe with as much wisdom as that the truth will be revealed, T.M. used to say that he would know that the race problem in America had been solved when in any city in the United States he had to put up his hand in front of his face to find out what color he was. From the first time I heard him say that, I thought to myself, yes, that is precisely right, right? And also precisely mysterious to those of us who had safely transitioned over the course of a couple of generations to whiteness, and who also therefore participated one way or another in the belief that we no longer had any color at all, because everywhere we went all the time, everybody was showing us that we was white now. But if you have to put up your hand in front of your face to find out, then it's apparent that there is nowhere yet a solution to the fundamental problem of the inequality. And this, after all, is Thoreau's point as well. To be not aware of being a woman, how could that ever have happened? How, for an instant, could I not have been aware of being a woman in this profession, all those indignities? And look at all the ones who leave. Where do they go? Why don't we study that? A good question. Roughly equivalent to the question, what do we know about whether punishment deters, asked by Oliver Wendell Holmes 100 years ago. I'm still not sure we have made any progress in answering that question, but one thing I can say for sure is that we have made little or no progress in understanding why it is that women leave the profession so much as they so much do. I mean, progress in understanding. It's dimness, right, that we don't make progress in understanding. It's not having an appreciation of the subtlety of the constant effort to sustain dignity against all the indignities which men in a dignified profession do not face, and therefore do not understand that someone else is facing. They do not have to hold their hands up in front of their face to find out that they are male. Now, of course, this is only the beginning of the subject, because we haven't thought about Serriere yet at all. And so I suppose we'll have to take a little time at the beginning of next time to think about Serriere. And perhaps it is even wise in a way that we should do so. For Martha Thoreau, with all her sophistication and all her passion and all her subtlety and grace and all her hatred of injustice, still is, in some sense, a mediating figure standing hopefully, with the possibility of some achievement of justice in society between the places of Serrière and Captain John Brown. Pop to you soon.